Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Happy New Year to you. And to my gluttonous companion, Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello, I object to that.
Oh, gluttonous?
Yeah.
Well, it's too late now. We can't turn back time.
Couldn't possibly edit.
Yeah, we can't turn back time as Cher so memorably once sung. New Year in Italy, is there a culinary tradition?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, there is. You have cotechino, which is this like very fatty, it's delicious sausage.
Yes.
You boil it.
Ugh.
It's very loose.
Loose, fatty, boiled
pink,
sausage.
I mean, I can see Sarah, the producer, just
hang on a second. This is a pink, loose,
it's
fatty,
delicious.
Boiled sausage.
It tastes It tastes a bit like, do you know, you're sort of, well, you're not northern, you're from the Midlands.
Midlands, yeah, yeah.
But do you know what bacon ribs are? So it's like a cured...
Oh, yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Or semi-cured smoked meat, pink, delicious.
Pink.
Anyway, so it's a sausage and you boil it. You boil a sausage. And it's delicious. And you have it with mashed potato and...
lentils.
I was about to say lenticchia, but lentils.
Yeah.
That's prosperity money. Basically, the lentils are supposed to symbolise the money. So you have that at midnight on
do
New
you?
Year's Eve. Yeah.
Do you do that?
You do. And even if you go somewhere posh quite often, they'll bring a little sampling around of those three
things.
Pink
sausage.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
Cotechino.
Cotechino. Well, I'm glad I asked. make your New Year's resolution a determination to expand your mind and subscribe to the TLS. Use this special offer to get on board, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet, 5 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up this week, the frankly terrifying spectacle of 3 arts journalists trying to understand quantum physics and the subatomic world. Sam Graydon is one of them, and he actually does understand it, so that is a start. Your bluffer's guide to science starts shortly. The great Elaine Showalter will be on the line to tell us about the life of children's author E. Nesbitt. It's quite a shocking one, and we're running a feature about out-of-print books. TLS contributors tell us what should be back in circulation and why. Roz Dineen has superintended that feature and will be here in the studio. According to John Gribbin's new book, 6 Impossible Things, here are 6 ways of seeing the world. 1. The world does not exist unless you look at it. 2. Particles are pushed around by an invisible wave, but the particles have no influence on the wave. 3. Everything that could possibly happen does in an array of parallel realities. 4. Everything that could possibly happen has already happened, and we only noticed part of it. 5. Everything influences everything else instantly, as if space does not exist. I don't really understand that. 6. The future influences the past. Welcome to the world of quantum physics, in which uncertainty is both a condition of reality and a consequence of trying to understand it. Sam Graydon, who also knows a lot about poetry, has read Gribbin's book, which has the incredibly annoying subtitle The Quanta of Solace and the Mysteries of the Subatomic World. He's also read Lee Smolin's Einstein's Unfinished Revolution. He's here to try to make sure we, by which I mean me, are not completely baffled. Sam, hello.
Hello.
It's a terrible subtitle. Yes. Quanta of Solace?
It's an awful subtitle that I imagine he wanted to be the title, and the publisher said, I don't think so.
And there's no point, it's just a gag about James Bond that has no real...
Pretty much, yeah. He shoehorns his meaning in, which is that we try and seek solace in the face of all of this unknowable stuff via these six, or, you know, manifold ways of interpreting it. But that's a bit of a stretch.
Okay.
Terrible though it may be, Stig, it didn't stop you extending it to the headline, did it?
No, I think that's... clever. Yeah. Bearing in mind, I only understood, you know, between 30% and 40% of this. I thought, well, how am I going to do a headline here? I do know James Bond titles, and so the headline is "The World Is Not Enough," which is a wry response to it. Exactly. Sam approved it. Right. So we're going to go slow.
Mm-hmm.
Thea, is this for your benefit as much as mine?
Or? It certainly is.
Fine. Good. And define our terms. Quantum. What do we mean by quantum?
Now it's used very, very generally. To mean basically the subatomic world, everything in the world. Yeah, everything in the small parts of the world. But initially, it meant a specific thing. It comes from the Latin to mean how much, and was sort of used as to refer to a specific amount of something. In physics, it was used to refer to a specific amount of energy. That is to say, energy can only exist at discrete values.
Chunks.
Chunks. It was found out, it wasn't believed, and then it was found out and it was quite a surprise, that once you get down to the really small things, things aren't scalar, they're granular. They're like little bits of sand. Energy can only exist in discrete values.
No matter how small you go, there's always a smaller discrete value to go to.
Indeed, or that there's a base level and you have an amount of energy, and then if you want to put a bit more energy into it, if you want to energize it, it doesn't slide up to the next available one. It just leaps, and there's nothing in between it. There's one and there's two in the energy spectrum, and there's nothing in between.
So if something gets more energy, it goes from being at level one to at level two.
Yeah, and there's nothing in between them.
There's no transition.
No transition. There's no time passing between
it. Well, how does it happen then?
Don't quite, no.
And that may become a theme of this. This is why, in fact, the subtitle of the piece is Guessing at the Game God is Playing, because one of the kind of interesting facets to all of this is we're in the realms of high science.
Yes, and the frontiers of science as well.
But that doesn't necessarily give us some certainty. In fact, quite the opposite.
Quite the opposite,
as we'll get to. Okay, tell us about the double slit experiment.
In 2005 or something like that, the physics community... whatever that means, but they voted it the most beautiful experiment in science.
Beautiful aesthetically?
I think they probably mean mathematically and scientifically.
Okay. Ever?
Who this body of people were, but...
Are you in the physics community, Sam?
I am an interested and quite knowledgeable amateur.
Okay.
I studied it at school and kept up. My maths wasn't quite good enough, but I like the concepts and understand.
And does it connect with your love of poetry? There's a kind of a search for the ephemeral beauty here.
Yes, I think there's something behind that. The idea that, certainly in this type of science and in relativity, I wrote a piece on relativity a year ago or something, and those two areas of science particularly are searching for what connects everything.
One of the lines you've got, the act of measurement actively constructs the reality that is being measured, and that's both a true statement, but it's also very philosophical.
Yes.
It's the sort of tree falls in a forest line.
Yes, indeed. Well, and we'll probably get to that. Is it true? We don't know.
No. Feels unlikely, doesn't it?
It does.
Right, let's talk about the double slit experiment.
Let's talk about
the most beautiful experiment, I think we all agree, Thea.
Of course.
Yeah.
If I lined up a group of experiments, this would be...
That would be my most beautiful.
Yeah, it would be the most beautiful. How easy is it to explain, Sam? Can you do it?
I can do it. The nice thing about the double slit experiment is that it's one of the very few things in quantum mechanics that you can visualise, or at least partially understands in terms of our world.
Okay.
And I've got a nice quote from the great Richard Feynman, who called it the experiment with two holes. And he says that
I'm trying to keep my mind elevated here. I want everyone to know this.
It's only going to get worse later on.
There's an awful lot of
word comes into
exactly.
Play.
There's an awful lot of terms being used, and I'm not responding to this.
No.
Okay.
He said that it was a phenomenon which is impossible, absolutely impossible, to explain in any classical way, and which has in it the heart of quantum mechanics. In reality, it contains the only mystery, the basic peculiarities of all quantum mechanics. So that's probably why it was voted that, because it sort of encapsulates most, if not, well, all problems of quantum mechanics.
Go on then.
So,
lay it on us.
I will. The nice thing is it starts with something you probably did at school, which is water waves. you probably had a tray filled with water.
Yes.
And there, midway through the tray, there was a wall with two little slits in it.
Yes.
And then there's a little oscillator that sends straight, nice rectangular waves towards this wall. And then when they get to the slits, they form semicircles and form ripples that propagate out and kind of towards...
Through the wall.
So, yeah, it gets to the wall, and then at the point of the two slits, two semicircles start instead, and the ripples go in semicircles, like dropping a pebble into a pot, and they go out. And they cross over, and at some points, because they cross over, the waves are higher, and at some points, because they cross over, the waves are lower. It's a bit like bouncing on a trampoline when you get that double bounce, or you don't get any bounce at all.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens. The waves go about double the height, or they kind of fade out completely. So the same principle, as it happens, applies to light.
Yeah.
Because light is both, well, it's neither a wave nor a particle. It acts as if it is both a wave and a particle. And yes.
What is if it's not?
Well, we don't know.
Okay.
The thing with most of this is that you try to formulate it in terms that you understand, and actually the quantum world is filled with things that we have no reference point for.
Okay.
And so it's better to visualise it as acting as both a wave and a particle, when in fact it is some odd mixture that we don't understand of both of them.
Fine. So what do we learn from this then?
So we learn it happens with light, and you... After you send light through two holes, it acts as if it's a wave. And you can see that on the wall after the slits, you get sort of streaks of light, like lots of light, then darkness, lots of light, then darkness. The same is also true of electrons, that is to say, of matter. Electrons act in the same way. You can conduct the same experiment by firing an electron or a beam of electrons at two slits, and you get the same effect.
Yeah.
And that was quite a big surprise. Although you can argue that it needn't be a big surprise, because water waves are in fact made of particles, but they do the same thing. So it's like little particles create wave-like interference.
And everything is little particles.
And indeed waves. Everything that is matter has a wave-like nature, and it has a particle-like nature. So we and the universe, or at least all the matter in the universe, has a wave-like and particle-like nature. So that is quite strange. And then what the double slit experiment then leads you to ask is, okay, well, if we fire the electrons individually, what happens? So they can't interfere with each other. You can't have that overlapping ripples. And it turned out that by firing one electron at a time through the slit, an interference pattern, which is that wave-like up and down or big streak of light then darkness, that appeared. It emerged. So you fired one electron and then waited, and then one electron and then waited. And although you would think that by firing something through a slit, it would just arrive as a little dot, a particle.
Yeah, straight. You fire it straight through one slit.
Well, you fire it and it has an opportunity to pass through one slit or the other slit. But both slits are open and it has an opportunity to go through one way or another way. But even if you fire them individually, it becomes wave-like. So you are forced to conclude that it interferes with itself, or retroactively interferes with the other ones. It interferes with itself.
Yeah.
So it goes through both slits at once as a particle, or as a particle-like thing, which doesn't quite make sense. Or the other electrons that come after it know which slits the ones before it have come through.
Yeah.
And then interfere in a wave-like way with that.
So at the level of the particle, there is this ephemeral memory of things.
An intelligence.
Yeah. Well,
metaphorical.
I mean, metaphorical intelligence.
Yes. And it's more so proved because in 2013, which, again, it's all quite recent development stuff going on, they created a way to sort of close off one of the slits and then close off the other one and open the other one. So it sort of alternated. So that, you know, you had one electron going through one slit while the other one was closed, and then they swapped it and the next one went through one while the other one was closed. So you would think exactly the same as if both of them were open. But when they did that, when they closed off one, they all arrived as particles. They all arrived with no wave-like interference at the other end. So it was as if the particle knew and as if all of the other particles also knew that there was only one slit open at the time of them going through the slits.
So how could that be true?
We don't know. It's amazing. But it's completely baffling. And every attempt to try and find out, and literally every attempt since, I think, the 1970s, when this type of stuff was really in its peak, when they were able to measure the electrons individually, has created particles at the end
could
instead
it not be,
of waves.
I realise I'm not going to find the answer to this, but what I don't...
Enter stick.
Yeah, exactly. But does it not imply that if one's not... If their two slits are open, the particle is somehow separating itself and definitely going through two slits, and that creates interference? Because if you're blocking one off, it can only go through one, and it goes through one as a particle. So that would imply that when there's two open, it is not going through one as a particle. It is somehow splitting and going through both.
Yes, so that is... Without the sort of literal interpretation of that, because at the moment I think the electron is the smallest thing we know of, without the sort of literal sense of it splitting in two and going through it, that seems to be what's happening, as in the particle is it sort of interferes with itself. It somehow knows...
It's aware that there's two slits. Why do you have more than two slits?
Nobody has ever talked about that in a popular science book, oddly. Yeah. I imagine...
Why is no one trying that? Let's try it with five slits.
I imagine they probably have, and the same thing pretty much happens.
Fine. All right. Thea, do you buy that?
Well, is this what you mean by subatomic particles being wacky? Does this have anything to do with entanglement?
Oh, God.
No.
Okay.
But, I mean, it is wacky.
It is incredibly wacky.
Does this have anything to do with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which I feel is one of those things that...
Is referred to.
I feel like I metaphorically grasp that. My understanding of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is that when you get to the smallest level, the quantum level... Things happen, which means they're not predictable. Particles go to places and you can't predict where they're going to pop up. And that reflects a certain sense that even if... Because there's this argument, I think you quote Tom Stoppard saying, at one version of reality, if you knew where everything is in the world, you'd be able to say what's going to happen next because you'd possess all the information and therefore you'd know what follows. But Heisenberg's uncertainty principle actually says you can't know everything because things keep moving around and you don't know where they're going to crop up next.
It's not to do so much with the popping up. You're right in the fact that it's about the fact that we can't know everything. Or you don't have to be so anthropomorphic about it. It's the fact that things can't be known.
Yeah.
So the uncertainty principle states that there are things called conjugate variables, which are kind of...
Still sounds a bit dirty, doesn't it? I mean, virtually everything we've talked about has had a dirty second meaning. Conjugate variables.
Conjugate variables.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, right. And they are linked...
Just trying to lighten things up.
They are linked properties of a particle. The traditional one is position and momentum. So those two things are, in a fundamental way, linked to each other as a properties of a particle, so that if you were to know an awful lot about one of them, you, as a result of that, know less about the other one. They kind of act on a scale. So if you kind of know half of the information you want to know about position, you can kind of know half of the information you want to know.
We don't know.
Don't know. Or at least certainly no one has bothered to explain it to me. A lot of these things might be
in deep physics, or
in very, very deep physics, but it just so happens that things are linked, and that if you want to know the exact position of a particle, you can't know anything about its momentum, and that's fundamental to things. That's not about us measuring things. It's not about the apparatus not being good enough. It's a natural fallout from this odd wave-particle duality nature of matter. That is what happens as a result of that.
Thea, should we talk about NADs?
Yeah, well, one question before we come to NADs, because I've in and amongst my many scribbles on your elegantly written piece, Sam, is in a massive bubble, time is not linear, !
Indeed.
So...
And yet, it is.
There are two competing theories. It's either you have to effectively say, and this is due to entanglement. In fact, if you don't mind, I will explain entanglement, and that will help explain that.
Yes, please do.
Go on.
So entanglement is when two particles are linked, usually by being created at the same time, but there are other ways to link them. They sort of work as a single system. So there are two particles, but they share properties between them. The thing that people talk about in popular science books is they share a property called spin. Spin is nothing to do with spinning at all. And it can exist in two states, which are called up and down, but could be called whatever you like. So spin is shared between these two particles. And as you make a measurement of one of the particles, the spin becomes fixed. So you will measure it, and it will either be up or down. And the other particle, therefore, will fix into the opposite. So when you measure this, it will be up, the other one will be down. That seems very logical, and it seems to suggest that actually the particles were just up and down. They're in a pairing, one's up, one's down. One is an apple and one is an orange. But no.
Of course not.
It turns out that, and I can't quite remember how they know this, but it is a proven fact, and they've actually taken a photograph of entanglement happening somehow. It's not an apple and an orange. They are, in fact, both. They sort of are mixed. They are both apple and orange. Both particles are apple and orange simultaneously.
Up and down.
Up but and
not,
down.
But not transitioning constantly or
no, they are sort of, they are a kind of field, a medley of up and down all the time in what's called a superposition.
A medley of apples and oranges.
Yeah.
Sounds delicious.
Pretty solid.
Yeah. But when you make a measurement, suddenly it is fixed into one and other.
So the world does not exist unless you look at it.
Yeah, there is some basis for that. And the problem, apart from the obvious problems with that, is that you know immediately what the other one is. So you measure it and you know one is up.
Yeah.
Because you've measured it, it's up. But you know, therefore, immediately, that the other one is down. So this suggests, and it can be that the other one is on literally the other side of the universe. They can go bumbling off.
Well, what makes them a pair?
This odd pairing, this superposition, this entanglement with each other.
Is everything a pair?
P-A-I-R, not P-E-A-R.
Yes, indeed.
No. It's an apple, an orange, or a pair.
No, then no pairs.
So we're talking about pairs as if that's like a natural thing. So are all particles
no,
paired?
No, not all of them, I believe, are pairs. There are ways in which particles can become entangled and some are created entangled, but not everything is
can
entangled.
They be entangled in more than two groups of two?
I don't think so. I found no reference to that.
Fine. So why does this stop time being linear?
Well, so the implication of faster than light communication is because it's incompatible with relativity. Nothing can travel faster than light. And there are ways in which people say that actually information isn't travelling faster than light because you have to compare results before you're absolutely sure that one is up and one is down. But they always correlate. It always happens that if you make a measurement, one is up and the other one is down. So the way to explain faster than light communication is either that time does not exist or space does not exist. They are the two options.
Because they could be very far apart, and by measuring them, you fix one into one position, and therefore you're communicating instantly with something that's geographically millions of miles away.
Yeah, and well, if space doesn't exist, then that's fine because it's not travelling any distance.
But if space does exist, it's travelling million miles in zero time.
Yes.
Which means time doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And yet, common sense dictates that time and space both exist.
Indeed. But you would, in fact, Carlo Rovelli, who would argue that time is not linear, and Lee Smolin, who would argue that space is not fundamental, would both say that's kind of anthropomorphic, a very human way of looking at things.
You're so human, Stig.
Yeah. Our view of the world is very limited. And it certainly does not apply to the world of particles.
I think if people are interested in NADS, which I presume they are, who isn't, they should read Sam's piece. Because I feel that I'm I feel like I've slightly understood this tenuously. I think if we go further, I might lose what slender grip I have. And maybe if I understand it, Thea will not be able to understand it. And when Thea understands it, I will not be able to understand it.
And am I an apple or a pear?
Yeah, exactly.
Or an orange in this scenario?
Well, you're a very clever man, Sam. I enjoyed that. Did you enjoy that?
I need a lie down.
Yes, we won't be having a lie down. But, Sam Graydon, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Edith Nesbit, or E. Nesbit, as she was on the page for the usual Victorian reason of gender concealment, other times she used her son's name, is probably best known as the author of The Railway Children, of which I suspect no British child born before, say, 1990, can be unaware. The story of an innocent father accused of espionage and his band of children who must prove the falsity of the charge with the help of a benevolent old man on the 9:15 train that goes past the house and a Russian exile, was first serialised in the early 1900s. A film followed, plus two TV adaptations, one of them hugely successful. I know I'm not the only child who dreamt of someday having a train line at the bottom of the garden, or who regularly stole her granddad's handkerchiefs to wave at trains. No red petticoats were available. It's all very nostalgic and sweet. The world of The Railway Children was one in which boys were boys and girls were girls. There was a threat, sure, but justice prevailed and all ended nice and soppily. Great. This was the Victorian family idealised to the nth degree. Which doesn't quite square, or in fact doesn't square at all, with the author's own domestic experience, as two new biographies make abundantly clear. Elaine Showalter has read both books, The Life and Loves of E. Nesbit by Eleanor Fitzsimmons and The Extraordinary Life of E. Nesbit by Elizabeth Galvin, and joins us on the line to paint the picture, pretty shocking even beyond the Victorian context. Hello, Elaine.
Good morning.
It's difficult to know where to begin, really. Can you give us the bones of E. Nesbit's biography, and then we'll sort of wade into specific parts in more detail?
She's in this incredible generation of women at the end of the 19th century. Some of them are bohemians, and some of them are in the aesthetic movement, and some of them are Fabians, and some of them are Marxists, all kinds of women, including Eleanor Marx, is one of the most famous. And they are extraordinary radicals, exemplary figures in every way, terrible taste in men, somehow managed to find absolutely the worst men, you know, in the whole group available in the cohort, very unhappy personal and sexual lives. But Nesbit, who makes her name and career as a writer of children books, and even, as it's been said, invented the modern children's novel, which I think is an accurate description, has one of the most scandalous, shocking personal lives, lives in a kind of ménage à trois for all of her married life, married a truly awful man and stayed with him for 34 years. And along with this, I mean, you can sort of go on from that. Yeah. Every attribute is fascinating. None of them fit together. She's a great fashionista, really somebody who made the Liberty dress forever the costume of the advanced woman. Glamorous, great hostess, a great cook, an incredible athlete. Never-ending list of fascinating
But when
traits.
You say ménage à trois, it sounds in some ways, well, that sounds a bit fruity, but really what we mean by that is a husband who sort of kept a mistress in the same house as them, and E. Nesbit had to bring up their children.
Yes, well, in the beginning she didn't know. I mean, this young woman, Alice Hodson, came to live with her because her husband was still living with his mom. She got her friend to come and move in with her and help with the housework and help with the kids. And pretty soon, the friend, Alice, was sleeping with the husband, you know, when he came over to visit, and had two children by him. Edith adopted both of them as her own and didn't know for a long time that he was actually the father.
And we should say that he's called Hugh Bland, which can only be taken ironically, really.
Yes.
He sounds like a singularly horrible person.
He was, but he was quite remarkable. And he's a character much written about by the men of the period. Shaw, Wells, Arthur Ransom, everybody knew him. He was really a charismatic figure. He joined the Fabian Society early, and he kind of found his métier because he was quite a good journalist. He was a boisterous, large man who wore a monocle, you know, kind of working class advocate, you know, Marxist, socialist, and so on, all for the working class, dressed like the most grotesque parody of a toff. He was wearing, you know, a top hat to work as a clerk with his monocle and so on. And men all distrusted him and disliked him and write terrible things about him. And women seem to have been tremendously attracted to him. So that classic paradox, the irresistible cad.
Some of what you've said makes her sound like she was a revolutionary. She was different, but she really, in many other ways, was not. And a lot of that was sort of backing up what Hugh Bland argued.
Yes, I mean, it's exceptional. She should, by all rights, absolutely, this is a feminist. You cannot look at the life and you cannot imagine that she's anything but a feminist. She supported the whole family. She started writing very young. She worked incredibly hard. I mean, she never stopped writing. People have descriptions of her sitting at the dinner table writing and smoking simultaneously and turning out all of this stuff in the magazines mainly. To support, eventually became five children, and incredibly radical in all of her personal taste. And he, of course, is one of the great misogynists of the period, completely unabashed, outspoken misogynist. And on the subject of suffrage, he says, votes for women, votes for children, votes for dogs. I mean, that's the way he represents it. And Edith goes into the Fabian Society and gives a speech against women's suffrage on the subject of the disabilities of women. Absolutely horrified the Fabian women who had come to the luncheon, and sustained this view, absolutely supported him in his misogynist arguments.
And what was the reason? Was she too weak to deal with his arguments? Did she believe it herself? Was she just placed in a situation where she couldn't have free thought?
There's no way that you can describe her as helpless. No, and I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the biographies. There have now been four biographies. There were two in the 20th century, both of them quite remarkable. One by a woman who wrote it just 7 years after she died and, you know, kind of interviewed all the friends and family. And then one later by Julia Briggs, who was an Oxford academic who I actually knew, a wonderful, remarkable woman and kind of a vivid personality herself, who wrote a tremendous biography of Nesbitt. And now these two simultaneous biographies, both of which very, very good, and they have to answer the question, why? What is the reason behind these contradictions? Why did she stay with him?
What's the answer then, Elaine? Why did she stay with him? That's the most baffling one, isn't it?
Well, there are two opposed views, and I'm not sure I believe either one of them. One is that she just adored him. She couldn't live without him. She was totally devoted to him, and he ruled the roost, and perhaps there's some kind of sexual mesmerism there. I don't believe that entirely at all, really don't. And the other is that somehow she was a sinister creature and she had him in her thrall. She was much more successful. Somehow he knew in his heart that she was the superior writer and the better earner and so on. And she made him feel it. That's what H.G. Wells said. I think it's more a product of her childhood. She had quite an unhappy childhood, drifting around with her mother all over Europe, rarely in places that she liked, kind of traumatic childhood in many ways. And I think once she got into the marriage, there were things that worked to her advantage. It was not that easy to get a divorce. They had five children they were raising together. And they had rather collectively a good life. I mean, they collaborated sometimes. She had a wonderful country house in Kent that she turned into tremendous showplace. I mean, really the British equivalent of some kind of great country salon. And people went there, artists went, writers went, everybody went, and she cooked enormous meals. The description of her in one of the books, running out of food and having unexpected guests, and she makes them a yard-long omelet and serves it up.
Oh, I'd love a yard-long omelet.
I know, you can just picture it. I mean, it's wonderful. So she had a great life. Her clothes were spectacular. Everybody talks about the clothes. You know, flowing silk gowns, lots of beads, lots of bracelets, scarves trailing everywhere, Turkish slippers, smoking all the time. It was a good life, and in a way, I think he was just finally somebody else in the house.
I mean, by excavating the life like this, do we gain insight into her imagination, why she wrote what she wrote the way she wrote. I mean, I hadn't realised... I only really knew her for The Railway Children and Five Children and It with the wonderful Samiad. She wrote really dark tales, though, didn't she?
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of horror tales and ghost tales. Some of them, I think, have just been reissued in a collection from Penguin. And they are very much the reflection. It's quite interesting. Galvin particularly analyzes some of these stories, and she said they're all projections of her anger about the marital relationship. I mean, one thing she certainly did not like is the other women in his life, and particularly having to make her peace with the one who was living with them.
Funny that.
And taking on the children. And she took it out in various ways. I mean, people began to say, the biographer said, that she really mistreated the children of the other woman. Even though she adopted them and kind of carried on in public that she had these five wonderful children, the adult children said, no, she treated those two children quite unfairly. And her own children said that she was not the greatest mother to them either, even though you have, you know, in The Railway Children, this saintly mother who was presiding over the family of the three children forced into sudden poverty. And it comes out, too, interestingly, in some of the children's writing. That's the more interesting thing, I think. It was quite late in her life that she found her voice as a writer of children's fiction. And the books, I think, are still very readable.
Yeah, where do they stand in the children? I was trying to work out, because I've read them, I'm sure, but they don't stick in my mind in the same way that, say, Swallows and Amazons did, Arthur Ransom.
Yeah, well, I think it depends on what you read. I mean, I think something like The Railway Children, which, of course, is a classic and so on, I think it's more of a book for girls. But I think that some of the other books that don't get so much attention and haven't been filmed are much more generally attractive and much more readable. I would recommend The Story of the Treasure Seekers, which has a male narrator named Oswald. He's a child. And he conceals, the first-person narrator, and he says, well, I'm not going to tell you which of us children is writing it. But he's an incredibly vain and comic narrator and constantly making remarks on the proper way to write a novel and the proper way to write a children's book. It is just hilarious. And I think in that book you get the full flavor of her voice, her kind of idiosyncratic, really very witty, parodic style. So I think she still has a way to go, you know, as a writer to be revived.
You mentioned Julia Briggs before you quoted her to say that Nesbitt was the first modern writer for children. What do you mean by that?
Well, what she meant was that these are stories about clearly modern children and real children, and they're not written at all in a Victorian voice or style. The children are recognizably childlike. They're very natural. The language is extremely natural. No kind of pompous locutions or Victorian idioms. And they are mischievous. They are bad. They steal. They can be cruel to each other. They are not, you know, lovely little kids at all, sweet little creatures. And they are almost always depicted in very harsh circumstances. Her favorite writer was Dickens. She was really steeped in Dickens. And they are more like Dickensian children in their situations. They are generally middle-class children whose families have encountered some disaster. Mm. The father has disappeared. All the money is gone. The mother is sick. Both the parents are sick. You know, that kind of thing. And the children have to kind of pitch in and find ways to help out. And they don't entirely know what's going on. A sort of a pre-Jamesian idea. The stories are told by the children. They don't know where the father is. They don't know where the money is gone. But they try to figure out and figure out how to help. And the ways they do it are very realistic and very entertaining and you know, very convincing. In The Railway Children, you know, they're freezing. They have to be very careful about the amount of coal, and one of the boys goes out and finds a way to steal coal along the railway tracks. He doesn't think of it as stealing. He's very good at it, and that's the kind of thing that they do.
I wonder about her being the first modern writer for children. Also, it has something to do with that holding together of the two things, the supernatural elements situated in this really, really real world, you know, with as you said, absent parents, a mother on hard times, wars rumbling around in the background. Obviously, that spoke very much to Britain at the time that she was writing. I'm wondering, just on a final point, if if she had much success in America, was she a thing there? Did she make it across?
Not at all. I mean, she had some American fans, and one of them, Gore Vidal, was a huge fan.
Seems unlikely somehow.
Yeah, well, it is.
Although, actually, maybe the Samiad.
Yes. Well, he just adored her, and he said the trick to Nesbitt is she really did not like children. And as a result, the children are extremely realistic, and he said they're like adults. And he said another very interesting thing. He said for Nesbitt, children are a kind of minority group in Edwardian England. They are powerless. And they are always at the mercy of adults, and that which lies behind the whole portrayal of them. So there's always a kind of dark underside.
I'll tell you what, Elaine, I think you talking about this and writing about this in the TLS is going to kickstart the Nesbitt revolution in America. People listen to this in America. We can begin the Nesbitt revolution now.
Let's do it. Americans, if you're listening, this is for you. Yeah. Catch up.
Get going. Elaine Scholzer, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye. I love the idea of catching up on something that happened in the 1890s.
Quite right too. I don't think about this very much, but it's amazing that presumably the majority of books that have ever existed in the world are no longer being actively published. Most have quietly disappeared, only to be rediscovered in secondhand bookshops, eBay, or the Amazon marketplace. Are we to accept the literary judgment of market forces? Surely not. So what treasures have fallen beneath the cracks? What great laboriously drafted efforts should be redeemed? Well, we, by which I mean Ros Dineen, asked a whole murmur of tearless contributors, it's a new collective now and I'm going for, to nominate the book that they would most like to see more widely available. And Ros is here to tell us what she learnt. Ros, hello.
Hello.
Do we believe in literary Darwinism? Do we think only the fittest books survive?
When you think about the books that have never been out of print, they're pretty impressive.
They're never out of print for a reason.
They're never out of print for a reason. You've got Emma, it's never been out of print.
Yeah.
Dracula.
Are there not many books that have never been out
no,
of print?
No, there aren't as many as you think. So, for example, Emma has never been out of print, and because of that, her other works have come in and out.
Really? Uh-huh. So her Austen's works haven't always been in print?
Has Little Women been always in print?
I don't know.
Okay.
Dracula has never been out of print. Gone with the Wind has never been out of print. Rebecca. The most
Rebecca.
Interesting
that's
one
great, isn't it?
That has never been out of print. The Pilgrim's Progress.
Oh, that
has never been out of print.
Surprise
that
me.
1678.
That does not surprise me.
That's 1678. I mean, that's quite...
I would think it probably comes more chance of coming out of print now than it almost ever has done.
Perhaps.
Because
yes.
It kind of speaks to a certain traditional religiosity that... But maybe...
Perhaps. Although I think academic curricula keeps certain works in print even when they go out of fashion, and then they're there when they come back into fashion. But in terms of, you know, do I think there's literary Darwinism... A lot of it has to do with what fashions and certain aesthetics survive.
Yeah. Market forces.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's but maybe that's the purest form of literary criticism.
Market forces, God.
Yeah, well, from a historical view, I'm not saying you know, in the day-to-day, but from a, you know, history, does history generally judge correctly? Seems to me an interesting point. You know, Walter Scott versus Jane Austen, the view of history has been Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
And insofar as you can make these sort of bald claims, which I'm going to,
mm-hmm.
Does history... get it right more than it gets it wrong, I wonder. I mean, maybe that's impossible to say, but there is definitely a historical judgment upon books, isn't there?
Mm.
But we're going to presume that there are some hidden treasures out there.
Mm.
What were recommended here? What struck you about this list?
There were quite a number of children's books.
Yes.
Which was, oh, it's really nice, actually. It was really sensible. I mean, there was one by Kate McLaughlin, and she recounts reading The Winter of Enchantment by Victoria Walker while at Brownie Camp in North Wales in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
At the end, she says, it's why I became an English professor.
And that's that. And yeah, I like the beginning of the book. A silver teapot suddenly winks at a boy, Sebastian.
Yeah.
That's a good beginning of a book.
Isn't it? And that's not in print. And then equally, Sam Leith chose a book called Grinny by Nicholas Frick. And I think it was it Stuart Kelly?
Kelly. Mr. Neverlost,
who has been lost because he's not... no longer published, by Archibald Turnbull. And these out of print books that, but also strangely the contributors weren't making a huge case for them to be reprinted, because there's something about how they remember them that they want to preserve.
Didn't you find a children's book?
I did. I found a children's book that had It was printed in 1927, called The House Without Windows by Barbara Newhall Follett. And I found it, found the PDF on the internet, and I thought it was strange, remarkable, and out of print forever. And mysteriously, it's now in print.
Is it?
Yeah. Is it really?
Yeah.
What, why did that happen?
I don't know, I probably blabbed too much about it.
Blabbed too much. Well, yeah. Now we're book publishers.
Effectively, we're doing that in this whole feature,
we are,
aren't
but
we?
Also, yeah. we're book publishers now, all three of us, for TLS Books. So we could, at any point, just grab one of these books and
well,
publish
that's what
them.
I thought had happened. And then I said, oh, I found this great book. And then and now it's been published. So there we go. So it's available.
Which
so we
would
should
you
be happy about that.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, and actually, I think discovering it, and the great pleasure in life is recommending a book, isn't it? I'd say one of the few unalloyed pleasures in life is recommending a book.
Mm.
And recommending a book that's out of print and is a lovely thing. Okay, it's each of us, the one we'd most like to read and why, please.
Do you want to go? Shall I go? I would like to read.
Dee's going to think about it.
I'd like to read some Dillis Powell.
Yes.
Who Ali Smith recommends.
Very good. I'd never heard of her. Should I have
I'm
heard
ashamed
of her?
To say I hadn't either. But
oh, yeah,
I
sorry.
Really trust Ali's judgment and everything and this.
So she wrote books about Greece, An Affair of the Heart, 1957, and The Villa Ariadne, 1973.
Mm. And she just sort of, and she also just, it was one of the only people here who just confident enough to just quote a huge chunk of the book because she thinks it just speaks for itself.
Yeah. I'm blown back to this book again and again is the very nice way she summarises that.
Yeah. And then there's another book which I actually have picked up, which Patricia Craig recommends, by Mary Ellman, called Thinking About Women.
Yes.
Which was published in 1968. And she says that Ellman's pioneering study was somehow unfairly sidelined in the subsequent rush to assert ideas of equality in every branch of women's writing. And I got a copy off of Abe Books, which is where you can get all of these out-of-print things incredibly cheaply. And it's very funny, which is often something that's missing from, you know, original Right on Feminist Criticism.
Yeah.
It's hysterical.
And is it of its time? Could it survive now?
I'm not sure if it could. It can survive now as a sort of interesting artefact, but it is, I think, of its time.
Because I was struck when I read, William Boyd recommends Turkey Hash, which is a bloke called Craig Nova. I think he's still alive. It's a novel in 1972. And the review said it carried the kick of a nail poked into a live light socket, which is a great line. And it's, as William Boyd describes it, a stark, bleak view of the underbelly of Los Angeles life written in a charged, cleverly wrought prose that marries Hemingway's monosyllabic heft with the dystopian lyricism that Scott Fitzgerald would not disown. And I read it, and it's very good, but it is very of its time. And it's a striking thing of this that it's not literary Darwinism, it's not necessarily even a judgment on the quality of the writing. I mean, some great writing transcends period, clearly, but some very good writing so saturated in its period that maybe you can read it as a tourist because it takes you to the 70s and maybe you want to go there. But it struck me reading that it was very good but wouldn't have a life in the 2020s.
There are actually very few examples of books that are taken out of forgotten mists and do incredibly well. There's Stoner.
Yeah.
By John Williams is the most obvious example. But there aren't that many stoners out there.
And also, Stoner wasn't actually that forgotten because we'd reviewed it a few years earlier or something. It wasn't as forgotten.
It was just repackaged.
And it was a kind of a marketing phenomenon.
Mm. Yeah. Anything you'd like to read here, Thea?
True to form, I'm going to represent the non-Anglophone.
Oh.
Because that's an interesting thing in this list, actually. A lot of people, or certainly some people, Richard Canning has one from a Dutch writer in translation. Marina Warner has one from, I think, an Egyptian writer. And then Claire Pettit, I really like the sound of her choices. And Mercè Rodoreda, which is a Catalan writer. And in fact, we had a piece by Colm Tobin, didn't we, not that long ago?
Yes.
On a reissue of Rodoreda. But then there's a book, so Gesualdo Bufalino. I've read Le Menzogne della Notte, which you sort of have to read in Italy. I'm pretty sure it's on the curriculum. And I found it quite hard going. It's set in the 1800s and it's on a prison island, and it's 24 hours in the lives of these four characters, a poet, a soldier, a baron and a student, before they're to be executed for being against the Bourbon monarchy. This is a book by Gesualdo Bufalino that I haven't heard of before, and it's Diceria dell'Untore, which is The Gardener's Rumour.
Okay.
From 1981, and it's set in Sicily just after the Second World War in a sanatorium for tuberculosis, narrated by a sole survivor who spends most of the novel thinking that he's dying and then isn't. Its febrile, darkly comic atmosphere reminds me, says Claire Pettit, of Gogol and Beckett. And it just, I think I should revisit Bufalino, basically. It won the Campiello. It was started in the 50s and he didn't finish it until the 1970s.
Oh, so there's a story around
there's always
it.
This kind of like yeah. waiting theme with him, it seems.
And also I think that books in other languages have the potential to be doubly lost, can't they? Because they never get translated, or they get translated once, maybe not well, and don't survive. And then just time itself sort of affects their chances. Roz, we have this TLS Books imprint, and we're going to try and publish an out-of-print book if the right one comes along.
And if we don't tell people about it first.
No. Yeah. Yes, thank you, Roz. We don't want other people to publish it, if at all possible. Should people contact you with their ideas? That'd be fun, wouldn't it? If people listen to this podcast... Contacted, did that be you? Should contact me?
Yes,
you look troubled.
Be,
I don't have to handle that. I tell you what, why don't you tweet? What's your Twitter account, Roz?
It's at Roz Deneen.
At Roz Deneen. I'm at Stig Abel. You're at Thea Leonarduzzi Street.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Pretty
we're
much,
all
I think
pretty
so.
Contactable.
There, yeah.
Yeah.
Directly tweet us and we'll try. I mean, we're interested. I mean,
yeah,
crowdsourcing.
It would also be interesting because I think a lot of people think that a book is out of print just because they haven't seen it in a while. I do this all the time. I'm like, oh, I haven't, that must be out of print. Yeah. But then it turns out that it is still in print.
So
often with a small or a university press, actually.
So we can investigate it. But in an ideal world, in 2021, we'd love to publish a book that's out of print now. That was been recommended by a listener to this podcast. That'd
exactly.
be great, wouldn't it?
And I think the thing about, you know, getting something like this off the ground and happening is that if someone comes along with an enthusiasm for a certain book, we're keen to be enthusiastic about it too and make it...
We're keen to be enthusiastic generally, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
Exactly. Roz Deneen, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Roz, to Sam Graydon and Elaine Showalter. I hope you enjoyed the first issue of the TLS this year. Do remember to make sure you're subscribing. Elsewhere in it, we have a look at how Harvey Weinstein got rumbled, a look again at Turgenev, and Lydia Davis is back in her garden. Next week, we'll be examining the Middle East. So New Year's optimism has not lasted that long. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.